Hi, my name is Evan and I use he, him pronouns.
And my name is Sasha and I use they, them pronouns.
And we are
the Baker Street Regulars, a podcast where we are taking a queer magnifying glass to the Sherlock Holmes canon and its many adaptations.
Hi, Zach. Welcome to Baker Street Regulars.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Can you tell people a little bit about who you are?
My name is Zach Barr, pronouns they, them. I am a playwright and director working in Chicago. I am also the creator of the ongoing video essay series And Now They Sing, which discusses the history of the performing arts and is available on YouTube. I was a guest on the second season of this series discussing Romeo and Juliet, talking about the Matthew Bourne ballet adaptation from 2019. Currently, I am in two different playwriting residencies in Chicago, one with Three Brothers Theater that will be culminating with a new play called Enduring Jest that will be this upcoming August, and then a following one with Filament Theater, also in Chicago, which will be running from October to November. I'll be building a new piece, which is essentially WrestleMania, but with poets. So those are the two upcoming pieces, and then I have various video essay stuff coming up in the next year as well when I'm able to get the time in.
We both love your video essay channel. We watch them as soon as they come out. And there'll be a link to that in the description of the podcast episode.
Yes, we're really happy that you're here with us today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a delight to be asked back.
What's your experience with Sherlock Holmes or adaptations of Sherlock Holmes?
It's very much rooted in the adaptations, though I have read some of the original stories, just a handful of them. But I would say the adaptation that I grew up watching is Great Mouse Detective, for obvious reasons. It's a Disney movie, and it's one of the better film adaptations that's not based on like a specific story. I've watched BBC Sherlock, except not season 4. The person that showed me BBC Sherlock made sure that I didn't watch the final season. We just stopped. They also made sure that we watched on the same day we watched Reichenbach Fall and The Empty Hearse, and she would not let me watch Empty Hearse until I had developed a bonkers fan theory for how he survived the Reichenbach Fall.
It's only fair.
So I really got the full experience, yeah. But no, I can't say that I have a great amount of knowledge about Sherlock Holmes. Certainly a lot of the research I've done now is in preparation for this episode, just knowing a little bit more about the canon of the stories. But I think I know what you expect to know from a kind of living in the Western world of, you know, Sherlock Holmes dominates culture pretty heavily.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's interesting to look at because in a couple ways, I think both of these musical adaptations we're talking about today feel like they're building more on the cultural understanding of who he is than they are on specifically the stories.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the two is kind of rooted in one of the stories, but even that one kind of includes material from all over the place, and the second one is a totally original story.
Well, we have a lot to cover, so why don't we dive into the first one? We're covering two musicals today. These are probably the most major musical adaptations of the Sherlock Holmes stories. The first is Baker Street. Mm-hmm. And the second is just called Sherlock Holmes, although I think now it's licensed as The Revenge of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, as you mentioned, these are the two dominant musical adaptations of Sherlock Holmes. The first one, Baker Street, was the only musical of Sherlock Holmes to run on Broadway. The second, Sherlock Holmes from 1989, is the only one to run on the West End. There have been various play adaptations, and there are other musical adaptations that have run either not in the English-speaking countries or have run in like smaller regionals, but these are the two dominant ones. They're the ones that, you know, Wikipedia recognizes.
I'm surprised that there's not more of them, to be like quite honest, that like haven't made it to like Broadway or the West End. Like you would think like Sherlock Holmes is perfect for theater and musicals, honestly.
I don't know if I agree.
Yeah.
Perfect for theater, certainly, and I've seen play adaptations, but I think the big question that both of these have to answer is, when would this character sing, and would he sing? And, you know, are these stories that sing in some way? I don't know that either makes a really compelling case for the character Sherlock Holmes singing.
Yes, I would agree kind of with both of you. The question of whether or not there should be a musical adaptation of Sherlock Holmes, whether the source material lends itself to musicalization, I think is an open question. I'm of the opinion that there's nothing that you can't make a musical out of, but it certainly is, you know, presents a unique challenge when you have a character like Sherlock Holmes that is, you know, really scholastic in tone, and, you know, mystery stories as musicals, they certainly exist, but most of the ones that do exist sort of in the realm of something like Clue or Gentleman's Guide, something that feels more pastiche. But I also agree with the perspective that, like, with a character as culturally omnipresent as Sherlock Holmes that's existed for more than 100 years, and a medium like musical theater that's existed for about 100 mm-hmm. years, it's weird that we've only gotten two adaptations to make it to the largest stages in the world, especially considering that, spoilers, neither of them were received especially well. It seems like an obvious thing for someone to come in years later and be like, all right, like, there is no dominant musical adaptation of Sherlock Holmes. Like, let's, you know, make the one that everyone thinks of when they think of a Sherlock Holmes musical. But, you know, it's kind of a gap. There really isn't one, because neither of these are known by the general public.
Yeah, and I'm surprised after, like, the success of BBC Sherlock that nobody went back. It was like, what if Sherlock, like, was a rock musical? Like, I'm surprised, like, especially, like, that whole trend from, like, the late 2000s and everything, like, A Spring Awakening or Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson-esque Sherlock musical.
Yeah, the 2010s boom in Sherlock Holmes adaptation has mostly died off. I don't know if the Will Ferrell movie killed it or what, but now that it's in the public domain, I mean, this season we're getting two great Gatsby musicals, well, between this season and next season, because it's in the public domain. Mm-hmm. Where's the Sherlock Holmes?
I mean, I'd put a strong case forward that the thing that killed the Sherlock adaptation was kind of the twin shots of the Holmes and Watson from 2018, and then I think for the same year was Sherlock Gnomes. I think those killed it. But that's the interesting thing about, you know, comparing it to that. And I'm not going to say that I'm not doing anything about the Gatsby musicals, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, in the near future. But with Gatsby, that's a book that was under copyright basically until 2021. Like, not basically, it was under copyright until 2021. Like, there wasn't an ability to do anything with it. But Sherlock Holmes' copyright status has been much more up in the air, just relating to the fact that it's multiple, it's 54 stories over the course of, you know, I think it's published over like 40 years. And, you know, when we say that they recently entered the public domain, that's only in the U.S. Most of the Sherlock Holmes canon has been public domain in the U.K. since 1980, because that's 50 years since the death of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. There was a brief window in the 90s where it was back under copyright because they changed those laws, but I'm not going to get into it. Basically, since the 80s, it's been copyright-free. In the U.S., like, versions of the characters, early, you know, versions of the characters have been public domain, you know, kind of sporadically. And then in 2013, there was a court case that officially determined that the characters were public domain, even if elements from later books were still copyrighted. And the last Sherlock Holmes stories only entered the public domain in the U.S. in 2023. So, yeah, it is recent that, you know, the character has been fully open for people to do whatever they want with him. But, you know, Sherlock Holmes as a stock, you know, set of characteristics and, you know, a canon that people can work with has certainly been available for a while. And only one of these, you know, Sherlock Holmes 89, the second musical we'll be talking about today, that one was made in the UK within the window where the character was fully public domain. Baker Street from 1965 was made, first of all, in the US, and it was made during a time when they still had to get permission from the Arthur Conan Doyle estate. If you look up its listing on Concord Theatricals today, it's still listed as, you know, presented with the permission of the estate of Arthur Conan Doyle.
Interesting. Yeah, that, especially with the second one, that kind of puts it into perspective. And it's also making me think of when the BBC Granada series came out. It technically came out after the copyright came out.
And yeah, no, there's definitely, you can definitely sense with these two, again, not to speak my opinion too early, but you can definitely sense that the Baker Street, the musical, had a estate looking over it to make sure that it was canon compliant, whereas the 1989 musical might have had a little bit more free reign with the material.
Well, let's dive right into Baker Street. Sasha, you have fast facts?
I do. So Baker Street, A Musical Adventure of Sherlock Holmes, is a 1965 musical with a book by Jerome Cooper Smith and music and lyrics by Marion Griffith, I hope I'm saying that correctly, and Raymond Jessel. It is loosely based off of the stories A Scandal in Bohemia, with certain elements of The Final Problem and The Empty House. And it's kind of set around London in 1897 during the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Victoria. The original production was directed by Hal Prince, we love. When it premiered out of town, it did not receive favorable reviews, and actually Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock, the successful composing team of Fiddler on the Roof, were brought in to contribute additional material to the piece. As we researched when we were looking into this episode, Fiddler came out first and had its Broadway premiere in the fall. And then after it had its Broadway premiere and it was successful, they brought Harnick and Bach in to be like, hey, help us out. We're coming in the spring.
You have a hit. You're show doctors now.
The production premiered in 1965 at the Broadway Theater and then transferred to the Martin Beck Theater, now the Al Hirschfeld, where it closed November 14th, 1965, after a total of 311 performances and 6 previews. The cast included Fritz Weaver as Sherlock Holmes, Inga Swenson as Irene Adler, Peter Salas as Dr. Watson, Martin Gable as Professor Moriarty, and it is noted that in supporting roles, Tommy Toon and Christopher Walken both made their Broadway debuts in this show. However, if you look on Christopher Walken's IBDB, it says that his Broadway debut was 2 years prior because he was credited under a different name. He was credited under Ronnie Walker instead of Christopher.
In what?
JB and High Spirits.
Oh, interesting. So it wasn't his Broadway debut. It's his first show as Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
Yeah, how young must he have been in those first two shows?
He was like 22 when he did this show, when he did Baker Street.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Zach found a photo of Christopher Walken from the show, which we're going to post on the Instagram along with a couple other production photos of both shows.
Yeah. The New York Public Library obviously keeps very well-stocked archives of production photos from all Broadway shows. And I did dig through trying to find, you know, photos of Christopher Walken. Really only this one. The photos that are tagged with him, there's only one little set of photos, which is clearly from the song Jewelry, which is near the end of Act Two. He's standing behind Peter Gable. He's holding like this kind of jeweled scimitar and a very weird, unfortunate wig. But it's very weird because, yeah, despite the fact that he's in his 20s, you could clearly tell that it's Christopher Walken. When I started digging through the photos, I wanted to try to find a photo of young Tommy Toon as well, because I know that he was in the dance ensemble. And, well, I could certainly identify a couple of ensemble members that, like, you know, might have been him. The NYPL archives, there are several photos that are just listed as, like, unnamed dancers. And so, you know, I wasn't able to definitively prove that any of them were Tommy Toon. But unquestionably, he's in those photos. He's just not labeled.
My familiarity with Tommy Toon is I think of two things. I think of him dancing with Carol Channing.
Of course.
On TV. And then I think of him being in this, like for Disney World, when they opened Space Mountain, they did a whole television special. And it was him, Lucy Arnaz, and somebody else. And they did, like, the theme song for the opening of it.
He just pops up in odd places.
Did you know that he directed the Will Rogers Follies on Broadway?
Yes.
I didn't know, but I think it popped up because I looked him up because I was like, what else did he do? I was like, I know he did Nine. I know he was involved in, oh God, he had another big Broadway show.
Bessel Whorehouse.
Oh, right. Whorehouse. I don't know Will Rogers Follies very well, actually. It's a blind spot for me.
It's interesting. Its claim to fame culturally is that it was the weirdest show to win the Tony for Best Musical in a year that had a lot of shows that we, like, would later go on to see as classics. It was 1991, so it was a season that also included, like, Once on This Island and Secret Garden and Miss Saigon and Will Rogers Follies beat them all out for Best Musical. That was also, it was also off-Broadway. You had Assassins that year. That was the year where, shortly following the Tonys, Frank Rich wrote his famous op-ed in which he said that the best Broadway score of the year was Disney's Beauty and the Beast on film. An op-ed which allegedly was the thing that finally pushed Disney into making the push to bring the show to Broadway 3 years later. So I guess we kind of had Tommy Toon to thank for that.
Speaking of the Tonys, this show was nominated for a couple of Tonys.
Yeah, so it was nominated for 4 Tonys in 1965. This was the 19th Tony Awards, the same one that Fiddler on the Roof was involved in, as well as a show called The Roar of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd, which is notable for being written by Anthony Newley and Leslie Bricus. Leslie Bricus being the author of the other Sherlock Holmes musical we'll be discussing today.
So Leslie probably saw this show.
Oh, unquestionably he saw it, yeah. But then he waited, you know, 30 years to bring, or I guess 20 some years to bring his version to the stage. But yes, it was nominated for 4 Tony Awards, for scenic design, for best author, which eventually folded into best book of a musical, but back then you could get nominated for writing a play as well, best costumes, and best lead actress for Inga Swenson as Irene Adler. It lost best actress to Liza Minnelli, it lost book of a musical and costumes to Fiddler, but it did win scenic design, although I do want to point out that The Tonys were slightly different back then. Oliver Smith won Best Scenic Design, but he won it for all of his work that season, which included Baker Street and also two other shows. So even Baker Street's one win at the Tonys kind of has an asterisk on it. But yeah, ran a little under a year, had kind of mixed reviews. I'm sure you have in your notes the bit about Alexander H. Yes. Cohen as producer and his caveat for audiences.
Oh, yeah. Yes. So he really thought that this was going to be like a humongous event, like the event of the year, like no other. So he announced prior to opening that men would not be admitted unless they were clad in jackets and ties, and women would not be allowed into theaters. They had to wear dresses. They could only wear dresses in the theater. However, after the reviews came out, this policy seemingly disappeared.
Coincidentally retired, yeah. It's interesting because we talk about the, you know, Cooper Smith and Grudeff and Jessel are the authors credited on this, along with Bach and Harnack having written two songs that we'll talk about when we get into the recap. But the history of this piece is also very deeply tied up in Alexander H. Cohen as producer. He was the one that kind of spearheaded the project. Jerome Cooper Smith was the one that had the original idea of what if we did a musical adaptation of Sherlock Holmes. But it was Cohen that reached out to Grudeff and Jessel, who had been working as a songwriting team up in Canada, working on kind of a musical review up there for a couple of years, and brought them on. They had no like Broadway experience. Neither had Jerome Cooper Smith. It's interesting because like after this project, basically all the creators went off and did completely different things. Most of them went into television. So it's weird that they kind of, you know, all their stars aligned for this one project. But yeah, and actually as a fun fact, there's a very good podcast called I See Sherlock Everywhere, or I Think of Sherlock It. But they did a podcast episode where they interviewed Fritz Weaver, who played Sherlock Holmes in 2010. He talked a little bit about the production of the show. The person Alexander Cohen wanted to bring in as director was Joshua Logan, who had done South Pacific in 1949. But after some creative differences, he walked away from it. He ended up pulling in Hal Prince, who at the time only had two Broadway directing credits prior to this. He had producing credits. Obviously, he'd done Fiddler earlier that season, but he was still kind of, you know, getting his feet, you know, on ground as a director. And so this was only his third Broadway show that he directed as a solo director. And it's because of the connection to Hal Prince that obviously when they had trouble out of town, he was like, well, I just produced the big hit of the season with Bach and Harnack. Let me bring them in to write some new music for this.
Yeah. I just read Mary Rogers' autobiography or co-autobiography this year, and she talks about wanting to bring Hal into a project. People still thinking he was green because he'd produced more shows than he directed at the time. The podcast you're thinking of is called I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
That's what it is. Thank you very much. They go deep on basically anything that can even be tangentially connected to the Sherlockiana and Doyle studies. I have to, you know, obviously give the caveat that I am not a Sherlockian or to the degree that I have friends who definitely are. But, you know, again, it's everywhere. You can hear of him everywhere. He's all over the place. And you can even hear him sing in this one.
Well, that's a good segue, as any. The show begins with a scene. There's a scene before the overture, which I think is unusual, or was unusual in the 60s at least. But there is this sort of like action opening at the beginning of the show, where a man is looking for Baker Street outside, foggy streets of London. And when Sherlock Holmes' silhouette is revealed in the window, a drunk jumps up out of the doorway that he's been sleeping in and shoots Sherlock Holmes through the window. And then a beggar who is also on stage reveals himself to be Sherlock Holmes, pushes down the drunk, and also saves the captain, Captain Gregg, who's looking for Sherlock Holmes. And the curtain falls, and then the overture plays.
The show has it's got a cold open.
Right.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night.
I can't think of it.
I mean, almost.
Another show like this, from the time at least.
I mean, it is interesting that, like, you know, it's the comparison I would draw because it's not exactly the same, but it's something like, you know, Oklahoma famously had its kind of bait and switch overture where it started off with this really big, you know, raucous overture of what you'd expect from the 40s. And then the, you know, curtain rises and it's a woman churning butter on an empty stage. And, you know, that idea of, you know, setting for the audience's expectations right up front. And I feel like there's almost an attempt to do the same thing here with, like, you know, you open on this, you know, cloudy street and a gunshot and, you know, all this information being kind of immediately dumped onto the audience. But then you roll right into the overture and it kind of does, you know, throw your expectations a little bit of, like, we had this very serious opening, but now we're going into, I mean, if you listen to the overture, it's a really, like, you know, kind of standard 60s, you know, it's the highest energy numbers in the show. right there at the beginning.
Although it like starts with these big dramatic chords, just to like because we're in this big moment, and then it like calms down, and the rest of the show kind of follows suit.
Well, it feels like already the musical is like, we know we're not a movie, but also we can kind of be like a movie, do a cold open, and then the opening credits.
Yeah. Well, and of course the overture is doing a bit of problem solving here because it's covering what must have been a massive scenic change.
Yeah.
So we immediately get dumped into an exposition scene in Baker Street. Mm-hmm. The first piece of information we learn is that the Diamond Jubilee is 2 days away. I was like, that's going to be important.
That might be important. Stick around.
We watched The Great Mouse Detective recently, so I was like, the Diamond Jubilee, you say? They're going to replace her with clockwork. But we get that the person who fired the gun was Sebastian Moran, and the person who has arrived at Baker Street, Sherlock deduces to be a captain of the Royal Guard, and then launches into a song explaining his deductions.
Mm-hmm.
The song is called It's So Simple.
Come, come, your profession isn't hard to perceive. Your manner, your bearing, the very clothes you're wearing, that handkerchief tucked in your sleeve, a military custom, I believe. Of course you're an officer. Sandhurst, am I right? And you're too young for a major, and so I should gauge you're a captain.
Well, I'll be quite. Sir, I'm amazed.
You show surprise, and yet the facts are there before your very eyes. And it's so simple, sublimely simple, if you learn not just to see, but to observe. Put your brain to work, not just the optic nerve.
Do you guys have an opinion on It's So Simple as an introduction to Sherlock Holmes, the first time we hear him sing in the show?
You know, I think both shows do this. I think if Sherlock Holmes is going to sing about anything, it would be this.
Yeah.
Because this is what he writes about. Like, when you meet Sherlock in the books, he's doing a lab experiment, and then he also has written a treatise about the science of deduction that Watson finds in the paper. Or he just leaves it out or something. So, that, I think the idea makes sense. I think the execution leaves something to be desired for me here, because, you know, it might as well be spoken. It's barely a song.
I actually think it's pretty fun that they sort of musicalize the deductions that we come to know Holmes to do in the stories. If you're going to do anything with Holmes and make him sing, yeah, that's a point that makes sense to me. And I can't imagine him singing really anything else in some regards, because like he just doesn't seem like a character who would sing. To me, he's like the ultimate straight man, or like the ultimate like grump. Like I'm thinking of like in Enchanted when she's like singing in the park, and McDreamy from Grey's Anatomy is like, "Why are you singing? Why are we singing here? What's going on? Stop."
I think that because this is the thing Sherlock would sing about, I think they should go further with it. I think that he should get really big with the singing and like hit this, you know, higher energy moment of like the beauty of the science of deduction, instead of just like tossing off, you know, 20 deductions in 3 minutes, which is what he does here.
You want him to hit the Jeremy Jordan Santa Fe note at the end.
Well, to counter that very slightly, I would point to the title of the song, which is, to Sherlock, it's not a... I mean, it is a big deal in the sense that it's what he does, but to him, it's also, you know, not to belabor the point, but it's elementary. Like, he doesn't see anything particularly special about what he's doing in this number. He's just making deduction based on what he sees. I like the fact that the melody of this song is kind of... it's either half-spoken, where it almost feels like he's just doing it, you know, almost impulsively doing this sort of deduction. But then when you get into the melody, it's just kind of this, you know, simple, very classical melodic line that gets passed from character to character. You know, it's not showy. It's not him trying to show off and do, you know, a lot of cool things to throw Lestrade off his game. He's just speaking what he sees. I think it's also interesting as the introduction to the show, not, you know, ignoring the overture and the cold open, for the tone that it sets for like what this piece is going to be. Fritz Weaver in his interview talks about how there's clear DNA tying this piece to a show from 10 years earlier, which is My Fair Lady, which had Rex Harrison, who like couldn't really sing. But Henry Higgins was one of the first roles on Broadway that wasn't written for an opera star. It wasn't, you know, the not Cable, but the other one from South Pacific, where he's, you know, played by an actual genuine opera star in the original Broadway production. It's played by a classically trained actor who happens to be able to carry a tune every now and then. And I think that what they do here with this show is they, you know, establish that Sherlock is not, you know, it wouldn't make sense to take a character like Sherlock Holmes and put him into the world of something like a Guys and Dolls or whatnot, like a much more broad musical theater standard. You know, it's notable that something like Fiddler was the same season, which also has a relatively muted tone as far as not having, you know, showgirls and having a lot more kind of speak, singy vocal lines that are more in the tone of, you know, where someone would actually be speaking. If you look at something like If I Were a Rich Man, which is, yes, a more, you know, musical song than It's So Simple, it's still notable that that's almost entirely within the speaking range of the vocals. It doesn't go super high or super low, except in its, you know, most emotionally raw moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find it funny that even Fritz Weaver mentioned My Fair Lady, because when we first listened to this, like, immediately the first song, I was like, oh, this is just a Sherlock Holmes My Fair Lady sound.
There's a pretty cutting New York Times review, not of the musical, but of its cast album when it released in 1965, which is not very long, but it essentially ends with a paragraph that says, you know, the best thing about the album is that it reminds you of My Fair Lady and Oliver, but the worst thing about the album is that it reminds you of better musicals like My Fair Lady and Oliver.
Wow, that speaking sing thing is interesting. There's a song later called A Married Man, which is very much in that mode, but speaking of the cast recording, they have a cover on the album by Richard Burton of the song, which is even more speak-singy. He just, like, talks his way through the whole song. Feels unnecessary.
It's interesting, too, because there's another song, also in Act Two, from Holmes himself called Pursuit, that I'm sure we'll talk about when we get there, which is, I mean, has no... The only melodic singing line in it comes from a character that isn't Sherlock and also isn't on stage. Because, you know, in this moment of the most heightened that Sherlock has gotten, it's notable that, like, he's trying to retain this mode that he's established in the first song of he's going to, you know, be speak singing and just kind of talking in rhythm along with the music. But it's getting interrupted actively. Like, when he's in a heightened state is when the music starts to interrupt him and throw him off. I think that might be why I like It's So Simple as an introduction for Sherlock and why I really don't like the 89 version, but we'll get there. Because it establishes that, you know, we're in a stasis for Sherlock. This is, you know, what he's like normally. So when it gets bigger later and we do get larger, you know, more musical style songs, if you will, later in this show, it establishes that that's different for Sherlock, that we're entering a new kind of state for him.
Yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense because what you're suggesting is like stasis for Sherlock in this case is that he really doesn't sing. And I think that,
which
I think that also speaks to like him being sort of emotionally frozen, which this play is poking at sometimes.
Oh, that's like the most, to me, that's the most interesting thread of this musical is the way that they deal with Sherlock's, you know, ice cold demeanor, because that's, well, I would never, personally, I would never advocate for, you know, fidelity of tone in adaptation. I'm not going to be here like saying that, you know, Sherlock has to act a certain way or that there's, you know, it would be wrong to give him a tap number or anything. There are a lot of people, and especially in 1965 when they had to get it approved by the estate, there are a lot of people that would say that. You can definitely feel pieces where this musical is trying to walk this very fine line of, you know, it's got to be a musical, but it also has to be a Sherlock story. And there's certain tonal limitations that I feel that they feel that they're working within with the character. You know, they can't have him, you know, burst out into something that feels out of character for him. So, you know, finding that balance of what they can do to, you know, use the musical form to tell this story without, you know, letting it overtake the kind of more literary and serious tone of the book.
I'm going to jump us forward in the plot a little bit.
Yes, please.
The client is Captain Gregg, who is one of the Buckingham Palace guards with the funny hats. And he is about to be wed, but he wrote some love letters to American actress Irene Adler that he wants back because I think he's been actively threatened about this. And Sherlock doesn't want to take the case until he realizes that Moran was probably trying to stop Gregg from getting to him and Sherlock from uncovering some larger thing. So he takes the case because he thinks it's related to Moriarty. And then it's time for us to meet Irene Adler. Oh, also, wait, the end of this sequence really quick. We established that Watson is a widower.
Yes.
Sherlock's like, I have to go to the theater to meet Irene Adler. It's no place for a widow or all those scantily clad women running around. And, you know, I envy you. You have to stay in and read Baudelaire. And Watson's like, I've read Baudelaire. And he's like, all right, I think we can make the final curtain. I think this is very funny.
I have no clue what Watson stands would think of his depiction in these two musicals, because it could not be more different.
Yeah.
He's so much like... I think that this Baker Street gets closer to the purpose of Watson within the narrative, which is weird because it's the one where he has a slightly less, you know, there's a criticism of this musical where you could say that Watson gets too sidelined by the plot in Baker Street. But I think the alternate is that, you know, you try to make him too much of the focus and you give him too much going on. It makes sense for him to be like, I've read Baudelaire. My life is following you and being your assistant, basically. So it's interesting because his wife, I don't believe, is dead in the books.
She's not. No. But I think a lot of people think that Arthur Conan Doyle found it inconvenient that he had married her, you know, because there's a lot of like, yeah, I'm just visiting Sherlock Holmes for some reason. It certainly is easier to have her dead or, you know.
Yeah.
And she certainly doesn't appear in the other one.
No, it's much more, it's ironic because he is married to her in the other one, but she doesn't appear and is more actively dismissed in the other one. So having him be a widower here, I think, makes way more sense just narratively because, you know, it also allows, importantly, it allows for Watson to be the one who's like getting flustered over romance and women and things like that, which not only for, that's not just for him, but so we can have the direct contrast with the way in which Watson interacts with Irene Adler versus Sherlock, which I think, you know, is kind of an explanation of why Irene leans into Sherlock, is because, you know, the way that Watson treats her, not that he's treating her lecherously, but just like the interest that Watson shows in Irene Adler is very similar to the one that she's getting from everyone else. She literally, you know, the first time we see her outside of her performance, she's got a crowd of admirers around her. And then Sherlock, you know, aside from just being well enough known by her, he's the only one that isn't doing that, which I, you know, they make a point near the end of the show that that's the thing that she is most intrigued by about Sherlock, is that he's the one that's unmoved.
We get a character introduction song for Irene Adler. The song in the cast recording is called I'm in London Again. The song in the script is called Buffalo Bell.
Yes, so I'm in London Again was the original song written for this. It was in out-of-town tryouts, and I think the first previews for the show on Broadway, but after they determined that it was too, because it's a ballad, they were like, after they determined it was a little bit too blasé for her introduction as a character, this is one of the songs that I believe Bach and Harnack wrote, and now it's kind of an old, like a Wild West, you know, Irene Adler is an American actress working in Britain, and, you know, they gave her the quintessentially American dance number. This is the one that does have showgirls in it, even if they held it off until the second number in the show.
we got there.
They said, we gotta have the showgirls.
We gotta have the showgirls. I like this sort of like British Americana thing, especially as an American musical. Without having seen the number, I don't know how tongue-in-cheek it was, but it feels funny to depict American culture for an American audience through the faux lens of British culture.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, the performance of Buffalo Bell within the musical is a performance written by Americans pretending to be British people writing for a British audience that is being watched by an American audience. Yeah. Like, remind me to get back to this later when we talk about the other one, too. But it's interesting that of the two, if I didn't know anything about these two musicals and you asked me which of the two was written by Americans and which of the two was written by a Brit, I would have said this was the British one. It feels much more restrained.
Yeah.
And the other one is way more, you know, what we think of as, you know, a capital M musical. But this number is the one moment where we really get, like, you know, a showgirl number in this show. Well, I get also the introduction of the Irregulars,
yes,
but that's coming up.
Yes.
I love the Irregulars in this. They get the best songs. So we go backstage. Irene tosses off an anti-suffragette line.
Yes.
I wrote it down. She gives a toast to the downfall of all suffragettes, who would have women gain a parcel of rights and thereby lose a dynasty of privilege. And then this... I don't know, the rest of the show isn't about suffragettes. This never comes back.
Yeah, then we just move right on from that.
So, I don't know... I don't know what the state of what I guess would have then been called the women's lib movement was like in the 60s, but, I mean, are we supposed to side with Irene because of her saying this? I can't imagine so.
It's a very odd line, and I will definitely say, like, we should definitely preface this with the understanding that I hope people know that we have not watched either of these musicals.
No.
We are going off of the published scripts of both and the original cast recordings. So what we're really evaluating here in this episode is the potentiality of these shows. Like, we are reading the screenplay, not watching the film, if you will. And so I don't know if there's, you know, any amount of irony that was in this line, or, you know, whether it was, you know, how it was framed by the narrative or how else Irene was framed. But I will say, just reading it on the page, it's certainly like it dips for a moment where you're like, wait, what? What was that line? And then we just move on from it. And you're, you know, I don't know if it was meant to sit with people in a way that was supposed to be uncomfortable. It doesn't tie into her character later. Like, she doesn't appear to be. I mean, she doesn't appear to be particularly women's lib on her own, but, like, it feels weird to throw in this very actively anti-lib line, but I don't know. Is it from the books? Do we know if it's from the short story?
It doesn't show up in... I don't think it's from the short story.
I don't think it does either.
I mean, if anything, she's
no clue
a pretty
why it's there.
Liberated woman.
But I also find it funny because this same year, 1964, is also the year that Mary Poppins came out. This musical of Mary Poppins actually came out, like, months apart, so I'm just imagining like Glynis John's sister suffragette coming in and punching this Irene Adler in the face.
Wow, funny thing about those two things together. Holmes is one of the well-wishers backstage, and he gives a toast as well to crime, I think, and he offers her money for the letters, which she refuses, which confirms Holmes' suspicions that something deeper is going on than just simple blackmail. There are two stagehands who overhear this and report to Moriarty, which is a very, like, spy movie twist. Like, they were there all along. Mm-hmm. Moriarty has agents everywhere.
One of the publicity stunts that Alexander H. Cohen had for the show was a massive billboard above the Broadway theater where it premiered, which said, "Sherlock Holmes showed James Bond everything he knows."
Oh, wow.
So this is very much, like, there is an element to this piece. I don't know if it necessarily comes through in the writing, which feels like it is pretty, you know, to the time period when it's supposed to be set. But there's an element of it came out in the 60s, and the first James Bond movie was just a couple years before
that. I mean, that certainly recontextualizes the opening scene for me, that, like, this cloak and daggers, fog and gunshots moment, which is not canonical to any of the Sherlock Holmes stories, is how we start. Mm-hmm. I think it makes a lot of sense in retrospect.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting to look at which pieces of the Sherlock Holmes canon get pulled as important for every adaptation of it. It's natural that both musical adaptations that we're looking at really latch on to the idea of, like, Sherlock as master of disguise, because it allows for such interesting, you know, the quick changes in characters, you know, reveals that happen, which feels very theatrical, and it's, you know, it's natural that theater artists would lock onto that. And also the inclusion of, as we're going to talk about in a second, the Baker Street Irregulars, which, despite the fact that they only show up in a couple of, like, three of the stories, I believe, they're in both musicals, and they serve the same purpose in both, which is we need to have a dance ensemble.
I was going to say, if there's one thing that theater lovers love, it's strapping young men dancing a lot.
Right. For a moment, we get newsies. We meet the Irregulars. The head of the Irregulars, Wiggins, who is from canon, is dressed in, like, faux Holmesian garb, I think is really, like, touching and cute. I just think that's a really nice detail. But they do a big charm number called Leave It to Us, Gov, which continues after, like, half the song is after Holmes and Watson have already left the stage. They're like, mm-hmm. We have to do a big dance break, actually.
And I love that in the middle of it, Holmes is like, are you done? Are you good? Like,
I like what they do on the cast recording, too, because in the musical, he just, in the script, I should say, he has like a half a line, and then it says, like, Holmes and Watson exit as the song continues. But on the cast recording, they actually have him continue the line, and they, like, fade it out slightly to show him walking, like, actively walking away, which is very funny.
You will receive the rest of your instructions at 10 o'clock this morning in Serpentine Lane.
All troops report, 4 bells, Serpentine Lane. Got it?
One moment. Watson, I've been meaning to speak to you about the Royal Art Affair. Did you send off the telegram as I told you to?
Leave it to us, Gov. Leave it to us. Your every little wish is our command. Truer than true, Gov. We'll see you through, Gov. Give us a clue and we will do whatever you may have in hand.
We'll do a rosa at your beck and tosa. We'll give you satisfaction plus.
I will also say, of the two of these musicals, Baker Street's the one I have slightly longer history with, just as far as when I discovered it existed. It was actually in contention for the first series on my video essays when I was doing music adaptations of things you know that you don't know the musical. Just narrowly, if I had done a second season of that concept, it would have easily been on the list to include. But I remember listening to it for the first time to kind of like gauge if it was okay, and I remember getting to this number, Leave It to Us, Gov, and it was the one where I was like, oh, maybe this musical isn't actually that good. Because it does feel like it's the first moment, because, you know, you kind of have this you know, slower paced intro, and then you have your number from Irene, and then you're like, we're now in Cockney London, Gov, and blimey, you dad mista, and I'm like, oh boy, it's gonna change in tone, isn't it? And to its credit, not completely, but yeah, it certainly feels like the Irregulars, and we'll get into roof space number later, but like, they are the moment in the musical where, like, well, we can't have Sherlock dancing, so we better put something in for the people that are bored.
Yeah, and they're fun, but I definitely agree that they, like, it doesn't really belong in this musical.
Right.
Yeah.
But the basic premise is that Sherlock wants to do the gambit from the short story, where he goes to Irene Adler's place in disguise, but instead of Watson throwing the smoke rocket, he wants the Irregulars to do it.
Mm-hmm. Watson does not get a lot to do.
Yeah. And he isn't involved in the next sequence, I think. But he does exactly that. It's the scene from the book, sort of. I think it's funny that he shows up in disguise because she's met him, like, very recently. So, I mean, even though he's supposed to be this amazing at disguise, it still is like, you know.
Well, I mean, he's the master of disguise, he's so the master clearly. Of disguise.
And to the musical's credit, she does see through it almost immediately.
Well, no, she doesn't see through it till, like, the end of the, like, halfway through. I think.
Well, no, because she says after the song happens, she has a line in the script where she says, like, the moment I saw you rifling through the letters, I figured you, this must be Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
So the whole number, she's playing up this idea that she hasn't been fooled, but she has.
That's true. But she is initially fooled. She's also reading the Sherlock Holmes stories when...
Yeah, I caught that too. That was weird.
Yeah. Which, like, canonically, Watson has been publishing the stories, so I guess they would exist in universe, but...
Oh, that's true.
For some reason in my mind, and maybe because BBC Sherlock has tainted my mind and with Irene Adler, when I saw that she was, like, reading the stories, I was like, okay, so she's the villain, and she's reading up on her dastardly foe that she's going to have to beat and stuff. No, she's just curious. She's just intrigued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is interesting that this musical has taken the character of Irene Adler, and it's weird because, like, if you want female adversary to Sherlock Holmes, you have Irene Adler. Like, that is the most obvious person you could pick. And then we have these two musicals, one of whom has Irene Adler, but she's not his adversary. And the other one has a female adversary, but it's not Irene Adler. It's very weird that neither of them could nail that.
Yes. And what's interesting is that, like, a scene or two from now, Irene basically becomes the main client of the story.
Right.
But she sings a song. She finds the letters and has him hold on to them for a second and then realizes that it's Sherlock Holmes and sings a song about what's in all of her, the letters from all of her various lovers, which features her impersonating three of them. The first, the King of Bohemia, a clear reference to the story. The second is a cowboy named Bill.
Because what else are you going to name a cowboy?
Right.
Riffin, you reject me. I swear I'll blow my head off with my custom-tailored, gold-plated, pearl-handled, diamond-studded, solid platinum gun! Signed, Bill.
I don't want to talk about the cowboy named Bill.
Yeah. And the third is Greg himself, the client, Captain Greg. So
I thought this number was fun.
It's a little long. It's the second longest song in the musical. And very little is actually happening. It feels more like a show-off moment for the actor. I feel like this is a big part of why she got that Tony nomination, because she's, like, doing a lot of things in this song.
Yeah. I mean, if Sherlock's world is that he kind of sings his songs and he doesn't, you know, do lyrical lines, this is, like, letters, and then later in Act 2 we have I'll Do It Again. Those are, like, the big show-off, like, showcase numbers in the show. Married Man a little bit, but we'll get there. But this is very clearly, like, you know, we have a show that is anchored by a lot of men. We have one major woman character, no disrespect to Miss Hudson, and we're going to show off that she can sing. Like, we need to have a really big ingenue number. And, you know, here it is. I also don't think it does much for the narrative.
No.
But there's a lot of songs in this show that don't do much for the narrative.
Yes. Which is maybe the thing about this show that feels the most old-fashioned, that the plot will often stop dead cold for a song and then continue.
Yeah. But not always. This is interesting about its placement in history is that, like, again, this is coming the same season as Fiddler, but it's also coming the same, or I guess a season after Hello, Dolly, yes. Where it's caught in this bind where, like, modern is, like, Hair is, like, 3 years away. But, like, it's in this bind where, like, it's late Golden Age Broadway. But, like, you know, after the death of Oscar Hammerstein II, but before Hair, where, you know, there are some songs like It's So Simple and then What a Night This Is Going to Be, which is the end of Act One, where, you know, there is a lot more narrative. Or, sorry, not the end,
say,
the end of Act One.
It should be, but it's not.
It feels like the end of Act One, right? And then we do get a Moriarty number, but whatever, we get there. There are moments where it feels like it's, you know, using the music to forward the narrative. And then there's other times where it says, like, well, this scene is kind of boring. Let's throw in a song to spice things up, which is weird because then you flash forward, you know, 25 years and the Brickus musical is arguably worse about how it uses music to interrupt the narrative rather than progress it. But again, we'll get there.
So she offers him the letters because of the effort he's gone through, which he refuses for some reason. He thanks her for the entertainment and leaves, and a doctor enters and the scene abruptly ends. So we're like, I guess that doctor's going to be important. There's a scene after this that's really, really short, which also interests me in terms of, like, the form and how it evolves, because
this is definitely, like, in front of the curtain while they're doing a scene change behind the curtain.
Yeah, this is a scene change scene.
It must be. But they have a couple of these that are just pretty short. So Captain Greg is patrolling at Buckingham Palace, and a man approaches him about the letters, and he breaks all the rules by talking during his shift. So we have, you know, this is an emerging threat. But we go back to Baker Street, and Holmes is angry because he doesn't have a case anymore, because he solved the letters case, although he didn't, because he didn't actually get the letters back. And Irene shows up with Lestrade to have him arrested, a situation he immediately defuses when he realizes the letters are missing. And this is the, like, switch where Irene becomes the client for the rest of the piece.
Right, she's like, yeah, he stole my letters, and arrest him, and Holmes is like, no.
Holmes is like, that's pretty interesting, Lestrade, leave. I'm going to deal with that. And they figure that it was the doctor.
He didn't ask the irregulars to ask for a doctor. Like, the irregulars wouldn't have actually gone to get one because they know that this is all fake.
Right. So Watson leaves to go check on the name of the doctor that she was given, which leaves Holmes and Irene alone together for the first time.
What it really is Watson leaves so that we can have this duet number without Watson present.
Because they're actually he's not determining anything particularly interesting, which he's just finding out that the doctor is not a real doctor, which I think Holmes already knows.
Yeah.
And they have a nice song about love.
Oh, yeah. Holmes is uncomfortable being alone with a woman. He offers her a pipe, I believe.
That is such a good moment. I love that. That's so... If there's one thing that I really respect about this musical, and this number is a good example of it, it's how they deal with the, like, Sherlock Holmes as a romantic angle, which obviously is, like, huge part of his character. Like, you know, there's so many adaptations that mess it up by, you know, pairing him off with someone, Irene or anyone. And so I respect the fact that in a musical medium, which is so dominated by, you know, having the two romantic leads as a trope, that they do hold to this idea that, like, Holmes just doesn't... It's not that he's not interested in love, he just doesn't get it. Like, the way they frame it is not him, like... I hate versions where they, you know, frame him as, like, holding back some romance that he feels like he, you know, is illogical to feel. But this one is just kind of like, he doesn't really get it, and he doesn't really need to, he doesn't see the necessity of understanding it.
Yeah.
And she makes a case to him, so that's the back and forth, is it reads like one song on the page, but it's separated out into two tracks on the cast recording. He has a song which is his case for not getting love, called Cold Clear World, and she sings a response song called Finding Words for Spring, where the thesis is, you must fall in love. I do want to mention really quick that before they go into the songs, Sherlock says that not only has he acted before, he invented Stanislavski's method.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Just...
Thanks, Mr. Holmes.
Right. I guess, thanks.
I feel like Holmes is more of a Meisner person.
That's a narrow cast joke. So Watson comes back and says the doctor doesn't exist, or there was a doctor.
He died 4 years ago.
He's dead. And Holmes is like, we have 12 hours to find Moriarty.
We love a time crunch.
And then we have this song, which should be the end of Act One, called What a Night This Is Going to Be.
What a lark.
What a laugh.
What a caper.
No laugh. What a spree.
What a splash.
What a binge.
What a bash.
You're a bit of all right.
Mr. Fights, you're a sight.
What a lark.
Weekend in the Country, yes.
We'll talk about the development of musical theater. Like, this is this type of song. After this, we start seeing all the time as Act One finales. But I don't know if I can think of an earlier example of this kind of song.
This is 65. I'm just trying to think of musicals from before then that would have a number. You know, the end of Act One of like, oh, shit's about to hit the fan number. Oh, well, I guess you could say Tonight from West Side Story. I know it's not the end of Act One, but that's
it's kind of like a song. This is a mid-act finale. Or a mid-act climax.
So Tonight, the Tonight Quintet is the last... I guess, actually, it's apropos for this, because it's the Tonight Quintet is the thing that ends... Like, it's the last sung number in Act One of West Side Story before we go into the Rumble, which is, you know, all just music. And this is similar to that, in that we have our last big ensemble number, and then the final scene of the act, which, yeah, I agree, should probably be at the top of Act Two, is them invading Moriarty's ship?
Well,
I don't quite...
But crucially, between the two, there is a dance sequence.
Oh, right, because they're, like, wandering around London.
So, actually, it's exactly like West Side Story, because there's this climax number about what's going to happen, and then it happens. There's a dance sequence where they're wandering around the criminal underworld of London looking for this doctor.
I wish there was footage of this dance number.
Yeah.
I wish so. So, if there's any musical that I want encores to do right now, it's this one.
During the dance sequence, they disguise themselves as members of the lower class. It's just Holmes and Irene. Watson isn't doing this. And they're going around to various haunts. I mean, this must be an interesting early Hal Prince sequence. I would love to see this.
Wonderful lower-class Cockney accents.
They do. Irene is flirting with Holmes. There's like a tall man following them. My favorite note, they are followed by a menacing giant of a man whom we shall know later as Murillo. Reader, we will not know this man later. Eventually, they find the guy. Irene signals to Holmes that she's found him, but it's too obvious. And Holmes gets dragged off by the killers, including Christopher Walken. And Murillo turns out to be working for Holmes. He grabs Irene and is like, go to this rendezvous point and the irregulars will get you out of here. And then he's murdered. And then she goes off after Holmes.
And then the act definitely should end.
But it doesn't.
But it doesn't.
We get one more glorious scene.
Yeah, because we actually have to meet Moriarty in Act One.
Right. So we're on Moriarty's yacht, which is acanonical, and it is described as being rich in Eastern treasure, which is fine.
And we're just going to leave that there and move
it's
on.
Nice.
It's nice.
He appears for the first time behind a giant rotating Buddha.
On a gong sound.
Well, no, the thing I want to talk about with the rich and Eastern treasure thing is that his plan is to tie up Sherlock and Watson, who he has captured separately, and then set off a bomb. So he's going to lose all the treasure. Like, why is he doing it on... He could have just rented a boat, you know? He just really had to make the dramatic Buddha reveal. Also, how big was this Buddha? He's revealed with a chalkboard behind him. Just nothing here makes sense. There's a giant revolving Buddha with a chalkboard behind it, which he's revealed in front of. And the chalkboard, there's a picture of it. One of the equations on the chalkboard that he's revealed in front of is E equals MC squared. Which I guess he...
Tony Award for Best Set Design 1965.
Right. I guess he invented it. He invented relativity in the 1890s.
I mean, perhaps there's a point that he's like, you know, it's fine if I lose all these Eastern treasures because I'm about to... basically steal the entire crown jewels from England.
Right. I guess.
I don't know. I don't know his methodology here.
Holmes is in disguise, and nobody's actually cracked the disguise. Holmes is still speaking in dialect, and Moriarty addresses him as his disguise character. And then Holmes, for no particular reason, decides to reveal that he is, in fact, Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say it out loud. In case it made sense to somebody else. Moriarty does the villain thing. He says what his plan is, which is to steal the crown jewels and escape via Zeppelin. And then he reveals that he has also captured Watson and sets a time bomb and then sings a song called I Shall Miss You, which does, in fact, end the act.
I shall miss you, Holmes, though your death is essential to my schemes. You must die, dear Holmes, yet as strange as it seems. I shall mourn as I have never mourned before. When the stately Holmes of England is no more.
It's one of the two songs that I know for sure was written by Bach and Harnack, mm-hmm. the other one being Cold Clear World. And I'm pretty sure that Buffalo Bell was by them, but I'm not 100% on that. It's interesting. I appreciate the fact, because so many villain songs are, if heroes get I want songs, villains get I am songs, mm-hmm. you know? It's like your Gastons and your Radigan, World's Greatest Criminal Mind, but also your My Name from Oliver. And I appreciate that, you know, they talk about Moriarty and Holmes being, you know, each other's greatest rivals and stuff. So I like that Moriarty's song is fundamentally a, you know, it hits the same note that Holmes hits in the second musical, which is this idea that, like, there will be no you without me. Like, you know, it brings me no joy to defeat you because you're the only person that's ever measured up to me. Which, honestly, you know, not to belabor the point, but it does tie in a little bit to the BBC Sherlock, because that's Moriarty's whole thing, is that he's, you know, so almost depressed by the fact that there's only one person that he can, you know, measure mm-hmm. up to. I shouldn't say almost. He is deeply depressed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a nice moment. I think, you know, it's the closest we get to queer subtext in this one, maybe.
Subtext.
Fair. Jumping right into Act Two.
Do we have to with Roof Space?
We open with a song called Roof Space, which is another charm number for the Irregulars. It might as well be Leave It to Us, Gov 2. It doesn't accomplish anything new. It's part of the long tradition of musicals having a song that is completely meaningless to begin the second act.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, people are still getting to their seats.
Right.
So
people are returning from their smoke breaks. They don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And you need a rousing number to get them back from the bathroom line, I guess. And I guess this does that.
Roof spice, roof spice for a shilling. Oh, the view is thrilling. Roof spice,
moving on.
Well, at the end of the scene, Irene's like, hey, you helped carry Holmes into my house. Holmes is in danger. Come help. And they're like, nah.
There's also this weird bit of fat phobia going on, because the premise of the scene is that they are trying to sell access to roof space to view the parade for the Diamond Jubilee. And the person who they finally convinced to get in their, like, winch system is a fat man. And I guess that...
A fat American
right.
man.
No, I think the American couple is earlier. I think this is a different guy.
Oh, is this a different...
Oh, yeah, I think the American
man.
Couple
okay.
leaves. But also there's an American couple, which feels very much like the American couple in Sunday in the Park with George, where it's like, what is this stereotype exactly?
See, maybe that's why I assumed it. I just assumed that the fat tourist was the American man because of Sunday's example.
But
yeah, no, I do not know why this number like is in the show narratively. I know why it's in the show, you know, logistically, because you do need a big Act Two opener. But even then, like, you know, it's just there's so much going on that you could have easily, you know, mimed this. Actually, you could have put the roof space winch off stage, because there's photos that was on the stage when they were doing it. I imagine that every subsequent, you know, restaging of the show has put it off stage because you just don't have the space to build it.
Right. And no one else won the Tony Award for Best Scenic Design.
Yeah, it's true. It's what you get when you build a winch system into your thing. I'll also point out that the number or the scene technically ends with the arrival of the Diamond Jubilee, which at least in the original Broadway production was done by Marionettes.
Okay, I wanted to know about this because here's how it's described. We see the Diamond Jubilee parade in all its splendor In a bird's eye view, military music can be heard after several regiments go by. Queen Victoria appears in her golden carriage, and the sound of cheering becomes overpowering as lights fade to black. And I was like, how are we doing an overhead view of a parade on a Broadway stage?
So I don't know exactly how they did it, because there are no photos of this parade. But I do know that it was marionettes. It was specifically Bill Baird's marionettes, which, for those of you that are following along at home and know my channel, that is the one moment in my Winnie the Pooh video where I showed a marionette version of Winnie the Pooh. That's the same company, and it's only 5 years before this musical.
And Bill Baird was doing a lot of stuff.
Is when that footage is from. Oh, Bill Baird was an enormous puppeteer. I kind of want to do a video on just him on his own.
But his puppets appearing in the Sound of Music film.
Yeah, which was the same year as this musical. It was also 1965. Oh my God. Right?
Am I not busy man. That?
Yeah,
busy,
that's right.
Busy.
Bill Baird was huge. And I imagine that, you know, I don't know exactly what they look like, but it's relevant that, you know, you'd have this one very theatrical moment at the end of Act Two that's, at that point, I imagine most of the audience is in at this point if they've missed the entire first number. But you have this fun little moment of, you know, actually showcasing. Because, again, they could have easily put this off stage. But, you want to talk about the place this musical fills in theater history, that it's, you know, it's trying to tie in the more modern contemplative style of musicals, which befits Sherlock Holmes. But even then, you got to have your Cockney street urchins and your marionette puppets. Like, you know, it feels like it's kind of going back and forth between them.
And Hal Prince loved a gimmick. Hal Prince loved a gimmick.
Yeah. And this is early in his career, too. Like, the last musical he directed was the comparatively, you know, staid She Loves
Me.
No disrespect to the musical, just that it wasn't a big flashy.
Right.
I mean, at the time, Baker Street was arguably the biggest Broadway show that Hal Prince had ever directed.
Right.
Wow.
So, you know, to have that budget and to flex it, like, you imagine that he's been holding back for the first two shows. When he has the opportunity, he's going
to
take it.
That's fascinating to think about. Yeah, I really wish there was a recording of this show, because early Hal Prince work, especially, I think, would be really interesting, especially because he's a young director trying to prove himself.
Yeah, he's only 36 when he did this.
Well, and also all the build up to the parade and to the Diamond Jubilee never gets paid off. The next scene starts with Holmes and Watson still on the boat with the time bomb, listening to the parade. It took me way too long to realize that the boat is like docked the entire time. They're not like in the Thames or something. They're just on a dock.
Oh, I just realized that.
Oh
too.
Yeah,
because that's how Irene Adler gets on the boat.
I thought she swam. Yeah.
I do think that there's one tiny detail I love in that moment when they're identifying the bands marching by the music they're playing.
I like that.
Because, of course, he can do that. But what I like a lot about it is that early in the show, he talks about how Watson he served in the military. I believe he's in the Northumberland 5th. And one of the bands that marches by, the first person, like Holmes, has been nailing all of these things. And then when one of the last band marches by and Watson identifies it first, and he's like, yep, that's mine. That's my band. I know them. And I thought that was a nice, you know, bit there that allows Watson to be more than just, you know, the tag-along.
Yeah. Which he mostly is in this show. But this is his big moment, because he gets a big solo here.
I just realized that he gets this big solo while tied to Holmes in a chair.
I think they're in different chairs.
They're in different chairs.
See, okay, my production, they're going to be back-to-back.
Well, they have to
on a rotating
We should say
they have to be tied with different lengths of rope, because Holmes is able to free himself in a minute, Roger Rabbit style.
Yeah. Although I do think it'd be very funny if they are tied together and Holmes still puts up the front of not untying them until way after he's about to defuse the bomb.
So Watson gets a song here called "A Married Man," where he reminisces about his lost love. I don't think this needs to be here. At one point in the song, actually near the end of the song, Holmes says, I'm glad that you have these memories, Watson. I am equally glad that I do not.
It's so good.
I think the only thing this song is doing is giving us a counterpoint to Holmes' relationship to love, right?
Yeah. I mean, you could argue that this is the third part of the trio that also includes Cold Clear World and Finding Words for Spring earlier in Act One. This is the perspective of somebody who, you know, isn't necessarily searching for love. He has found it and, you know, kind of settled into it and then lost it. I agree that I don't think it does much narratively for the show, but as opposed to something like Letters, which I feel like is just a showcase number that could easily have been cut, considering she has a better number coming up next, I like this one. And like I said, the moments when they can give Watson dimensionality because the plot gives him so little, I will take that.
A lonely man I took a wife and added love and laughter to my life. And I knew then there's no one richer than a married man. The joys, the woes, the happiness, we shared it all, we two. And though the woes seem so much less, and how the pleasures grew.
Peter Sallis, by the way, we didn't mention this. Peter Sallis is the voice of Wallace from Wallace and
Gromit. Right.
This was one of his early stage roles. I like him in this number. I think that he sings it very well.
Cheese.
But it is a very slow song to sing while tied up waiting for a bomb to go off. Because the entire reason they put the act break where it is to create this tension around this bomb going off. And then he just sings this, like, slow song inches away from it. It feels like maybe there's a better time and place for this song to have happened. But the Baker Street Irregulars and Irene show up to the rescue.
Fight the bad guys.
Right. They employ their various characteristics. They're like aggressively cockney at the bad guys. And then Irene Adler uses a feminine method by swinging her purse at somebody. So that's who
feminism.
They are, I guess. Well, she put a brick in the purse. Holmes frees himself from the chair because he held his arms in some way where they couldn't accurately bind him. And then everyone is talking about how difficult this bomb is to disarm, and then he does it in like 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
This is where Irene gets a big love song,
yep.
Which is called I'd Do It Again. Do you want to describe this song, Sasha?
I mean, yeah, I think it's just, at least to me, like a typical love song. Like, I'd fall, at least when I listen to it, like, I'd do this all over again with you, to be with you.
I think what's telling about it is that she is reflecting on, like, the many lovers she's had.
Yeah.
And, like, I think the song implies that she really did love all those people, that it wasn't just about status or power or whatever, as some adaptations make it out to be, that she's, like, loved and been burned over and over again, but is still choosing to love. Which is, I think, a really great counterpoint to the Holmes of it all.
If love should appear, it is only too clear, I'd pursue it again and breathe again.
I think this is one that, you know, the reason I was kind of hard on Letters earlier is because I'm like, well, she's already got this one. And this is the number that I think better communicates, you know, the role that Irene Adler is serving within this narrative. Like, this is the one that, you know, especially when we get to her real kick-ass line at the end of the show towards Holmes.
Yeah.
You know, it could be so easy to depict her as, you know, an ingenue in theater and kind of distill her down to that. But there's something else about her being like, you know, I've actually gone out and lived. Like, I've gone out and had all these experiences, and now I'm, you know, burned by some of it. But you know what? I'm going to keep doing it because, you know, what else is, you know, I can't live my life just studying what's going on the way that Holmes does. There's a quote from Werner Herzog that I recently posted on Instagram, which is, the poet cannot avert his eyes, which is the idea that, like, you know, when you look at the entire world just logistically and you look at it all through, you know, trying to measure it and, you know, understand it and, you know, to it all scholastically, like, you're not understanding the actual full breadth of, like, what it is to be around and stuff. And obviously, I don't think this number is that deep, but, like, there's an element of that. Like, that's the thing that Irene has that Holmes does it, is that she is open to the highs and lows of human experience, whereas Holmes is trying to, you know, glass bottom boat basically all of life.
Yeah, that's nice to see after, I think the last time we dealt with a direct adaptation of Irene was the BBC Sherlock episode that we did. And, mm-hmm. like, that episode kind of hates Irene. And it's nice to see one where the creators are like, no, Irene actually gets something that Sherlock Holmes does not. Like, she has a, you know, a valuable point of view. I think that's nice to see.
Yeah. And she sings it well. I think it's a good song. The score of the show, in isolation, the songs, they're up and down. Some of them are a little bit forgettable. But this is one of the ones that, like, I was humming it the day after I listened to it for the first time. It was like this and It's So Simple were the two that really stuck with me.
I have to mention, just because I think it's really stupid, that near the end of this song, the gong sounds again that signaled Moriarty entering, and the Buddha revolves to reveal Wiggins, who is like, Holmes said to meet you at this place, like, whatever, kind of like, here's the next thing dialogue, and then revolves back away in the Buddha. And it's like, yeah. First of all, he entered the boat with everybody else. When did he get into the Buddha? And then why does he go back there?
I think he exited with everyone else at when Holmes did, and then he, like, because the Buddha clearly has an entrance that's outside of the yacht, right? So, like, I think he left the belly of the yacht where they all are, found the entrance to the Buddha, entered to say this one line, and then exited, which, honestly, icon. That's the best.
We love it.
Big Wiggins move.
Yeah.
Big Wiggins energy.
Big Wiggins energy.
This is where we get Holmes' counterpoint, effectively, to her song, which is Pursuit, which is mostly not a song. We see Holmes in a carriage racing to, I think he's figuring out where to race to, actually.
Yeah.
He's racing. And
he's trying to figure out where Moriarty's going to pull off his escape.
What's fascinating about this is that in comparison to Great Mouse Detective, we don't actually ever see the main event. The jewel heist just kind of happens off stage, and it's implied that it did happen or that they're too late for it. So he's trying to figure out where Moriarty is going to take his balloon to, and Irene singing from offstage keeps cutting in and distracting him. What's the melody line she's singing here? Because it's not I'd Do It Again, is it?
No, it's from... Oh, is it from I'm in London Again?
Yeah.
Is it from the song that they
cut? I think
it's
from I'm in London Again.
I didn't really clock that the first time. I only just noticed that now. I think that the vocal line she's singing in this is from the song that is on the cast recording but isn't in the published script.
Which is maybe why in the script we have, which is why I'm not sure, in the script it just says she cuts in.
Yeah, it doesn't specify what she's
singing. In fact, maybe she doesn't sing. This is what it says in the script. Once again, Irene's music wells up as he is distracted by thoughts of her and dies away as he drives her out of his mind. So maybe she doesn't sing in this version of the script. It's just the, like, orchestra.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, we'd have to see what it looks like in performance. We can only go off of the spotted pieces of the OG that we have.
Because I'll admit that her voice cutting in on the cast recording feels a little, I don't know, awkward.
A little bit.
A little hammy.
I mean, out of place. I mean, it's just a little... Yeah, it's like it's the only time in the entire show that we get, like, a, you know, in order to understand how Sherlock's mind is going, we actually have something external that the audience, like, suddenly gets sucked into his brain for a second. It doesn't happen anywhere else in the show.
So we cut to... I say cut to. The next scene is the Cliffs of Dover, and we just get the Reichenbach Fall scene.
I mean, this is the Reichenbach Fall. Yeah, this is just taking that moment and translating it into this show. And there's no song here.
Yes, it's worth pointing out that following from the scene before it, the implication of the first half of the scene is that Irene has distracted Holmes in some sense and, like, caused his deductions to be less accurate. Like, the first, like, three or four things that he says as deductions, Moriarty's like, aha, false, actually. You misunderstood my plan or whatever. Until finally, Moriarty's like, you have no other choice. And then he's like, false, actually. And, like, does the Reichenbach Fall thing. So... in another adaptation, this would be the, like, triumph of Sherlock Holmes over the specter of women, but the story's not over yet. We have this image, another, like, short scene in front of the curtain of two funeral processions passing each other going different directions, with Moriarty's men and Sherlock's men with the two caskets.
Two caskets passing in the night.
Right. I was like, why are they going different directions? How many cemeteries are there in London?
Well, there's no way that they were going to be buried next to each other.
That's true, although... maybe they should have been.
Maybe they should have.
Of course, they're not going to because Moriarty's not in the casket, as we find out in a scene or two.
Yeah, as we find out in the next scene with maybe the worst number in the whole.
Well, but first, before we find that out, there's a scene at Baker Street where Miss Hudson comes up and is like, you know, they've posthumously granted him Medal of Honor. And then Irene shows up and she's like, I'm leaving town. I just wanted to pay my final respects.
She's leaving on the midnight steamer.
Right. And Watson moves a stack of papers revealing a smoldering pipe that he picks up and tries to pretend that he was smoking, which I think is a fun way to start this reveal. But then Sherlock Holmes just walks in from the next room. And I think it's wild to imagine that Mrs. Hudson doesn't know, right? Like,
oh yeah.
Yeah, when you put it like that, because I think that's a moment that they could have added real comedy to it, is if the bit where like, she totally understands, but she also completely gets that, like, to be quiet. Uh-huh. Like, she's like, yeah, it's not really my deal to reveal this to the people.
Not my business.
Yeah.
That feels very Mrs. Hudson.
Or she, like, it's like that one scene from Community where, like, Donald Glover walks in with the pizza and everything's on fire, and she's like...
Yeah, you know what? I'm just not going to deal with this right now.
Yeah. I'm seeing ghosts, so I'm going to ignore that.
Mm-hmm.
So he is trying to track down the last of Moriarty's men and find the jewels which are missing. And we cut to a funeral chapel.
From Moriarty.
From Moriarty.
So a chapel.
Right.
Sorry, I didn't want to let that one go. There is a funeral going on, yes, in this chapel. Yes. Being presided over and
by Dr. Baxter, because we've run out of bad guys.
Yeah, by the fake doctor. Uh-huh. Because we don't have a Wiggins that can run the Moriarty funeral. So Dr. Baxter, who made his startling spellbinding appearance for like one line, like a billion scenes ago, is running this number, and then he leads them all. He opens the casket, which doesn't have Moriarty in it. It has a bunch of all the jewels they stole. And then they sing what I, again, will say is the worst number in the entire show, which is basically just them talking about how cool all the jewels are.
We'll dispense with the reading of the will. Ooh, what jewelry? Lots and lots of jewelry.
Hang it on me in a Christmas tree. It's half so grand. Give me glittery things, emeralds and pearly strings, ruby rings on every finger of my hand.
This is the last song in the show.
This isn't even the finale. There's more stuff after this, but this is the last song.
There is no finale.
Yeah.
For a show that like has some pretty clear ideas about how to begin and end its first act and begin its second act, I find this baffling.
To its credit, I do think the end of Act 2 after this is pretty all right. Like, it matches tonally everything that's come before it. But then you have this one song just kind of sitting at the end of the show, like, you know, it doesn't feel like the ending. It feels like there should be one more, like, reprise of something after this to, like, bring us back to the normal tone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we've got this weirdly, like, upbeat ensemble of all the villains being greedy that just kind of drops in at the end here.
And Holmes is there.
So is Irene.
Irene.
They're all there.
Everybody's there. Holmes is in disguise as the man who built the bomb that he was tied up in front of earlier. Irene is in disguise as the church organist, and she doesn't reveal herself until after Holmes has had everyone arrested and they've cleared the room. And then Irene gets this really metal line that you mentioned earlier. She says, "Mr. Holmes, you are a fool. For all of your brilliant deductions, a fool, I could have given you an adventure beyond your wildest dreams, in feelings you have never known before, feelings that are not grit, but stimulation to the sensitive reasoning mind. What a pity that Sherlock Holmes has chosen to leave a mystery unsolved."
That rules. First of all, such a good line for her. Like, such a good way for her to exit this musical. But also, it's such a good way... I mentioned earlier that, like, there are various ways of dealing with Sherlock Holmes as a sexual character or a romantic character in different adaptations. You can either ignore it, or you can just, you know, treat it as just a default that you don't touch. But, like, I like this. It's such an interesting way of going about it by basically, like, you know... He's not interested in romance for the reason that everyone else is interested in romance. So Irene manages to frame the idea of romance in the only way that Sherlock Holmes would be into it, which is as an unsolved mystery. Like, how dare he who knows everything on Earth, not understand this one major thing? And then, to his and her credit, when she walks away, he's kind of thrown by it. And the musical ends, spoiler, with him, you know, basically getting on a steamer to go to America and follow her. Not even out of, like, you know, oh, now I'm so love-struck by her, but just in, like, a, you know, she throws down this gauntlet and he picks it up at the end, and he's like, all right, I don't understand what this is, but you are correct. I don't know why I'm holding myself back from understanding this. And that's such a good, interesting way of dealing with that problem, aside from just, you know, treating it as a roadblock of, oh, God, we got to not give him a romance.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're wrestling with it. It's cool.
I think it's just a little bit more indistinct than that, though, because... there's also this, like, plausible deniability thing he has, which is that Moriarty is probably still alive because he left behind a record in the church of him reciting Caesar, because we didn't talk about it, but there's a through line of Moriarty referencing Julius Caesar. Yeah. And so he's like, I need to search the four corners of the globe, and I'm just going to happen to start with America, where Irene Adler is.
Yeah. For no reason. I could pick anywhere, but I am just going to mosey my way over to America. Yeah. No reason.
But it's also, it leaves this place where, like, that is up to interpretation, where, like, the audience is like, oh, he is just happening to choose there, or it's for her, or he's in love, or, you know, like, I think a lot of that depends on staging, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's cool that it's unresolved.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think the correct interpretation of this ending is that she walks off and he clutches his heart and faints. Like, you know, he retains his, you know, Sherlockian demeanor the whole time. But, you know, I do feel like it adds, you know, if she hadn't said that line and the musical had ended exactly the way that it does without that line from her, it would feel a lot less rich, because it would feel like it's just another, like, oh, the adventure continues kind of ending. But it adds that additional little, you know, dramatic tinge of, you know, maybe there's something that's, you know, opening anew for him beyond just continuing to hunt Moriarty. You know, whether that's romance or whether that's just him being more open to not dismissing it out of hand like he did in Cold Clear World, you know, it adds another dimension to the character.
And that's Baker Street.
That's Baker Street, the 1965 musical. So as we said, it closed after 311 performances on Broadway. Was nominated for some Tonys, it didn't win. As far as I can tell, I did some research for it. So the show is still licensed. There are no upcoming productions of it as of this recording. The most notable subsequent productions of it was York Theatre, which is off-Broadway, does their musicals in Mufti series, which is basically like concert readings of shows that never get done. And they did Baker Street in 2001.
Ooh.
And that was the last time it performed in any major theater in New York. But there is not another, like, you know, big revival push for this one. I was considering when I was, you know, reading it in preparation for this episode about, like, do I feel that this musical needs to have, like, do we want the revival of it? Do we want someone to come in and fix it? No, not really. I think it's much more along the lines of, like, you could strip it for parts. I think that there's a lot of good music in it. I think that, you know, there's plenty of songs in it that, you know, we already, you know, highlighted Merry Man and I'd Do It Again. And even if you wanted to do Cold Clear World, like, you know, there's songs in this that you could take out and either use for audition songs or, you know, put them in cabarets or record them. You know, you could probably could do pretty good jazz covers of a lot of these, a lot of like those, you know, 60s era you could do. You know, it's just kind of it's a show that not a lot of people know, but the score, you know, I certainly would say if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't listened to the score, go listen to it. It's worth listening to the OBC. Just for, you know, the performances and the music. On my channel, I talked about A Doll's Life as a musical that I think has, like, great potential but just wasn't quite there in its original production. And it ran, you know, like, 1/60th as long as Baker Street did. But that one, I do think, like, there's something in that piece that can be pulled out if you, you know, rip the book apart and cut it down and, you know, trimmed it up. I don't think that, you know, especially considering that the material is public domain, like, I just don't think that, I think you could just write a better Sherlock musical. I don't think you need to put the effort into fixing this one.
Yeah.
But then again, I don't think you should forget it. I don't think this is a musical that needs to be cast into the darkness and no one needs to talk about it again. I mean, we constantly have been talking just in the conversation about how it's this, you know, midpoint between, you know, the history of musical theater and the history of Broadway. And I think it can serve as an interesting milestone for that.
Yeah, I think, to me, the most appropriate direction for it to go is New York City Center Encores doing maybe a production of it in the future, just to give it, like, some sort of life or, like, bring it back for, like, a moment.
I think I more agree with Zach that maybe the great Sherlock Holmes musical has yet to be written. And I think part of the problem that this one doesn't particularly surmount is that, like, the stories are mostly short stories, and they're often fairly breezy. Often they're like kind of quick in-out stories, and this ties a couple of them together.
Mm-hmm.
But I still don't think that the whole feels worthy of a, like, musical length runtime. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. What I don't think it fails at is, you know, it is fundamentally, you know, at like we mentioned, the plot of the show is pretty directly a Scandal in Bohemia, the first Sherlock Holmes story, although there's elements, obviously they have the Reichenbach, or a equivalent of the Reichenbach Fall in there. And I don't think that it's a problem of, like, it feels too episodic. Like, it definitely feels like it flows. as a narrative, but I think what it doesn't do is have the good meshing of like which pieces of the story are being told by the music versus what's being told by the book. For those that know, actually, this is a good way of putting it. If you know Lindsay Ellis, the video essayist and author, yes, she talks, because she's done a lot of videos about musical theater, specifically film musicals, but she's talked about the stage as well. She talks about the, quote, hunch, the musical scale of musicals, which she never defines, but I understand it's based on a parody of musical theater from the TV show The Critic, where Andrew Lloyd Webber writes a Hunchback of Notre Dame musical. But the idea of it, as I understand it, is that like the hunch scale of musicals argues how much does a musical justify the existence of its songs, either through them being super catchy and like really beautifully written, or, you know, do they forward the narrative? And I think that on both of those scales, that's where Baker Street messes up, because the songs are either like nice to listen to but completely irrelevant to the story, or they are attempting to move the narrative forward but they're kind of forgettable and repetitive, or the lyrics just aren't very good. And, you know, there doesn't really have a song that, you know, nails both. Maybe I Do It Again is the one I would, you know, uphold as being, and I guess it's also Simple, as being the two that kind of, you know, toe that line the best. But I feel like it's pretty, Baker Street and we'll get into Sherlock Holmes the musical, I feel like they're both pretty high on the hunch the musical scale of musicals. They both feel like you're, you know, kind of attempting to shove songs into a narrative that doesn't really need them.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree on that, especially when it comes to Sherlock Holmes the musical.
Game is up.